Hey, I'm Jordan Donica.
Hello, everyone. I am Dominique Mariso.
Hey, everybody. I'm Kent Gash.
Hi, I'm Marshawn Davis, and you're listening to the Call and Response Podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Call and Response Podcast with Felicia Fitzpatrick. And recently, y'all, I just wrote my first piece for Zora, which is a publication by Medium that is for, by, and about women of color. It was so exciting. I dove into my experience as a curvy biracial girl doing ballet in the Pacific Northwest. And like a small plug, y'all should check it out. I'm really proud of it. And it was interesting to reflect on these experiences. A huge part of it had to do with the Nutcracker, because that was the one thing that kept me in love with ballet for so long. And of course, now it's still a beloved holiday tradition, but now it's from a seat in the audience rather than on stage. And of course, it's as if Gold Star knew this, because Company XIV's Nutcracker Rouge was a featured event this week. It's an edgier take on the holiday classic, blending burlesque, theater, cirque, and dance. Gold Star has even more options for holiday fun, including the Blues Brothers' Blue Blue Christmas, A Christmas Carol, the Radio City Rockettes, and so much more. So download Gold Star, and let's make some memories, y'all. And I know, every week, I'm like, I'm so hype, I'm so thrilled, I'm so excited to introduce that week's guest. And this week is no exception, because y'all, it's another level this week. I'm so excited to get to talk to my first Ain't No Mo cast member. Marshawn Davis is a Lortel and Audelco nominee. And so yes, you may have seen him at Ain't No Mo with the public like I did 3 times, or in the Great Society at Lincoln Center, or in The Day Shall Come, that was recently released.
On the big screen.
On the big screen. Like, you're doing the damn thing.
Yeah.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm excited we get to chat.
Me too.
Because, of course, yes, I loved Ain't No Mo, but then getting to meet you for the Playbill Instagram Live, I loved you just as much in person as I loved you on stage.
Oh, thank you.
You know what I'm saying?
Thank you.
Like, you have such a warm energy about you. You're so generous in spirit.
Not everybody says that. No, I'm just joking.
Who are they? Let me know. You tell me after. We're going to go talk to them. No, and as I told you that day, like, Ain't No Mo is such a special show, and we will get into it today. But so I'm so excited to hear like more about your journey as an artist and a creator. How I love to start the podcast in that regard is to know, how did you get involved in performing arts?
How did I get involved in
yes.
the performing arts? So it for me, it started when I was pretty young. The first thing I ever did was a film, and I was an extra. And that film was Toni Morrison's adaptation, the adaptation of Toni Morrison's book, Beloved.
I'm sorry, what?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that was one of the first things I ever did. I was like 6 years old, 7 years old.
Starting off strong.
Yeah, I was only an extra.
But
I was
still. Back right.
Not only, I was an extra.
That's right.
I was very excited to be on that set.
Own it, yes.
Yeah, I was actually.
It
was like one of the most, as a kid, sort of magical experiences I think I had. I remember like getting up early and going to set in the big tent for craft services. When I say it was nice, it was nice. I actually remember more of craft services than I do the actual filming or anything
and
like
fair
that.
Fair enough, though.
Yeah. I remember Oprah came around once to craft services just to say hi to everybody.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes.
What was she like in real life, in the flesh?
She seemed nice, but she wasn't like, she wasn't at the O Network
right,
and a lot at the Tyler Perry Studios. You know, she wasn't, she wasn't the Oprah we know today.
You, I got you.
She was Oprah in 1995.
Right.
Which was a while ago.
Wow.
So yeah, I think that's kind of how it started. And for me, it was like through music is where I found my sort of itch to be an artist and to like, to tell stories, because I would watch the movie musicals growing up.
What were some of your favorites?
Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang,
we
love
you.
You.
Yes! I love that one, except for the Child Catcher scares the hell out of me still.
Yes.
But that's iconic.
That one and The Music Man and, you know, The Wiz. And, and Sound of Music. You know, my mom loved watching those, so we would watch them too. And I think I just fell in love with musicals back then through those films.
Mm-hmm.
Through the, like, the what was it? It's a the film version of Oliver.
Yeah. Yeah. Like all those 1970s kind
of those 1970s, 1960s. Oh, yes.
Right.
I my film musical knowledge goes
that's
back.
That's so funny. I love that. I love that.
So that's kind of where it like the fire, where the the sticks were brought to the fire. If you want to say that.
Right.
And I think where it began to get ignited was when I went to high school. I went to the Creative and Performing Arts High School of Philadelphia.
Shout out.
Yes, because I love my high school and I love my city.
Yes.
And I think through there, I kind of realized that the kind of work that I wanted to do, I think I wasn't really sure, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like when you're in high school, you're like, oh, maybe I'm going to do this or maybe I'm going to do that. But before that, I was like, I'm going to be a lawyer. And then I was like, nah, I can just play a lawyer. And
right. Well, you get to experience a lot of different things that way.
Yeah.
You know?
And so it was at Kappa where I was like, I wanted to kind of be a music teacher, a music educator. And then I was like, oh, no, I got to perform. And so I went to college for musical theater. And then I ended up going to a summer program, which like set it off for me, which I think that was the point where I was like, oh no, I'm going to make a living being an actor.
That's when it clicked.
Yeah, because you know, I think I had all the other tools before, but I didn't know how to do some of the things that I saw folks like, I don't know, like at this summer program, we saw, it was in London.
Oh,
it was British American Drama Academy, Midsummer in Oxford.
Ooh.
And so I, and a lot of folks go to this program, but I, through that program, saw a lot of theater,
mm-hmm.
a lot of classical theater, a lot of Shakespeare. And I was like, oh, I want to be able to work like that.
Yeah.
I want to be able to do that.
Right.
And so after that, you know, I met some cats that went to grad schools here in the city and up in New Haven.
Yeah.
And we talked and I ended up applying to grad schools and the rest is kind of history from there.
Wow.
Yeah.
There's something too, about, like you said, Shakespeare and classical works. Like there is a kind of melodic musical quality to those performances, like movie musicals in my mind,
mm-hmm.
you know, or like the big monologues that feel like breaking out into song in a musical.
Yeah.
Did you want to pursue a specific type of theater or were you open to everything?
Did I want to pursue a specific type of theater? I wanted to be able to do anything I chose, anything that excited me.
Mm.
And at that time, I there were things. What got me at BADA was Fiona Shaw was doing a workshop.
Fiona Shaw, okay.
Yep. Fiona Shaw, Fiona Shaw.
Yeah.
She was doing a workshop with us. And in that workshop, two of my good friends now, they were doing a scene from Julius Caesar, the tent scene from Julius Caesar. And they were working in a way that I was like astounded with. You know, they were fearless and ferocious. And even if they were still figuring out what they were doing, they went at it with all of their being. Like every inch of their body they were acting with. And I was like, I saw that. And, you know, I had a monologue prepared to go.
Mm-hmm.
I had a monologue from Women of Troy, a Trojan women, a Greek monologue, Menelaus. And I was afraid.
Wow.
And I didn't go. And I didn't get up. And I knew in that moment, I was like, oh, there are a couple things that I need to learn.
Wow.
Yeah, it was basically that fear that sort of like catapulted me into being like, oh, it's not that I like necessarily wanted to only do classical text, but I didn't want to be afraid of it.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I love that you say that because I feel like there's a lot of moments that we can all be intimidated, but we can let that fuel you, but it has to be in an open, I want to learn kind of way, not shutting down and running away from it kind of way,
mm-hmm.
you know? Wow. So when you came back, that's when you went to NYU Tisch?
I came back. I had a year left of undergrad, and then I applied. And within that year, I applied to grad schools, yes.
Oh, my gosh. And then how did the first year feel?
First year of grad school?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God. First year grad school was a lot. You know, that summer I did a Williamstown Theater Festival.
Okay.
The end of my first year. And I remember that, like, I felt like, don't take this analogy the wrong way, y'all, but I felt like an X-Men, right?
Okay.
I felt like Jean Grey.
Okay.
Where, like, I had all this, like, potential and things that I was learning to harness, like this power and this like I had like an enormous amount of power that I at times was not even aware of that I was learning to harness. So I felt very raw at the end of my first year.
Okay. Yeah, raw.
Yeah.
That's a real feeling.
Yeah. I felt exposed.
Yeah. Like you had peeled back the layers almost.
Yeah, and I was like, there's a lot here that I knew, but like I never investigated. And so grad schools give you the time and space to investigate all those things in a safe environment.
So what's one of the things you felt like you investigated that you really learned from?
One of the things I investigated... I feel like that's kind of personal.
Yeah?
Yeah, some of them are kind of, you know what I mean? Okay. It is kind of personal. But I think that on a more general level.
Sure.
For me, it was, I really learned how to work with all different kinds of people within different environments and settings.
Okay.
So communication was like key. Like yeah. I learned to process the process, and I learned that in order to get to anything, there has to be a process, right? You know, and that it's okay to fail within that, and to be uncomfortable within that, and for it to be a bit messy within that.
Yeah, and to not like let fear.
Yeah.
Lead you.
Yeah, like the unknown is actually the greatest ally and asset to an actor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think it is so crucial to learn how to communicate and at least be able to understand other people's perspectives in theater, in the rehearsal room.
And because like people ain't always gonna agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've been out of school for 3.5 years now, and I've worked on some things in which I didn't necessarily agree with what and how the story was being told. But like, you have to find a way in. You have to find a way to sort of make it work. Yeah.
Do you when it comes to those kinds of processes that you may be feeling unsure about? What are your, like, I guess self-care is the word that comes to mind, practices, like do you journal or do you have like a support network of fellow artists and creators?
What do you mean by that you might feel unsure about specifically? Like
you're saying there's sometimes you've been in shows that you might not necessarily like agree with the vision of.
Yeah.
So when you feel like unsure about that and you try to find that way in, like you said.
Yeah, I try to honor the character as much as I can. If I'm playing like a real person, then I think about that person and what they actually had to go through. If I'm not, I think about people that have been in that space, you know, if it's not an actual person, do people have been in that space and experienced that? And so I try to honor them the best that I can whenever my ego gets in the way, you know, my ego dragon. I try to honor them. But in terms of self-care and taking care of myself, I like to put it away. You know, when I'm done rehearsal, I like to put it away.
Right. Okay.
I like to put things away. And I like to fill my time with other things. I like to watch stand-up specials. I like to go to the movies because movie theaters still exist, even though Netflix, Amazon, and Hulu are around, and now Apple TV or Apple Plus, but I don't even know what it is.
Disney Plus, all the things.
Yeah, all
Amazon
the things.
Prime, yeah.
Amazonian, Prime is in all the new platforms.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, so I like to go to the movies.
Yeah.
The other night I saw Jojo Rabbit, and then I think one night I went with my friend to see Hustlers.
Okay.
I like to just go to the movies and enjoy a freaking movie.
It's like kind of an immersive experience in a way, like going to the theater and going to a movie theater versus like sitting on your couch and watching it. For myself anyway, because I know having your phones out of movie theater and the theater is a hot topic right now, but like I at the movie theater put my phone away, whereas when I'm watching Netflix I'm like, oh, I'll check my Instagram.
When I'm watching Netflix on my computer, I'm actually on my Gmail and on Twitter,
right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
I'm never just watching.
You're never just focused. Yeah, I feel that.
So yeah, I do all those things, and I have a support group of friends. I find my allies in the rehearsal process. You know, people who sort of understand me, understand where I'm coming from. People that I like, I feel like our sort of communication aligns in a way that like it isn't hard for me to talk to them. You know,
express yourself and
express myself in a way that I don't have to censor. Because processes happen. Sometimes they're, like with Ain't No More, what, we had 2.5 months? I mean, from start to finish was like 3 months. 1 month of rehearsal, 2 months of the run. With The Great Society, what has it been, like 4 months or so? Like 1 month of rehearsal, 3 months of a run.
Yeah.
And so those processes are short. Or though the ones I've been a part of are short, you know, a lot of people get to do shows for like a year.
Sure.
I haven't done that yet.
Yeah.
So you find people that you don't have to try.
Right. Where it just feels easy and natural.
Yeah.
So let's talk about Ain't No More. You said it. I was like, I'm gonna try to wait as long as I can. No. We just gotta dive in. Because I feel like what you just expressed, like you could see the camaraderie, you could see the friendship, you could see that essence on stage between all of y'all.
Yeah, I love them.
Like,
we're family.
I believe it. I bet the group text is fire all the time.
Well, we know. I mean, I'm not a group texting person.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
I'm like the last one to respond on a group text.
That's so funny.
I am. I don't do group texts unless it's with my family.
Okay, shout out to
Shout out to my family.
Yeah.
But like when it comes to theater work, I'm rarely doing a group text.
Interesting.
So yeah. We do have a couple group texts.
Yeah.
Where when something happens, people will like share. Yeah. We have those, but the process in the room.
What was it like?
I mean, it was wild. We loved each other. I mean, Crystal Lucas Perry was our promoter.
Yes.
When you have Crystal Lucas Perry in your show, you don't have to do any press. They don't need to hire a press department. Like save that money for another show.
Yes.
So like we would always just turn to Crystal to be like, "So do you have any photos of us doing this when we posted?" You know,
right.
Crystal is like that kind
distribute
of
distribute them to us.
Yeah,
please.
Yeah, yeah.
Her Instagram was amazing.
Yeah,
I have to say.
But also, like, on top of that, we're so respectful of each other. So Crystal would be like, she would ask, or like we would be like, not right. We knew when it wasn't the time. When it came down to like work in that space, we worked in that space.
Yes.
And to be honest, sometimes we even worked outside of that space.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I mean, for me, I was coming into this process, a little more cold than the girls because they had done the show at the Public Studio.
Oh, yeah. Right.
And so there, any moment I got to sort of like play with it a little more, jump in a little more, I would.
Yeah.
So one night when we had like set some of the stuff for the sermon in the beginning.
Ooh, yes.
They then had to go to the studio and record it with the organist.
Oh.
And so I was like, do y'all mind if I come with y'all? I know y'all don't like need me to, but like I would love to like build that in the studio with y'all together.
Yeah.
And so we did.
Wow.
So the things like that, it was a space in which all ideas are welcome, because that's the kind of director Stevie Walker Webb is.
Yes.
It was a space where you felt like you were coming home every day.
That's a beautiful, beautiful sentiment.
Yeah.
And you could, and that's, okay, so I know I keep saying it, but you could feel that. Mm-hmm. Like the cohesiveness between y'all as actors on stage, Stevie's direction, and Jordan's writing was like seamless.
Yeah.
It was seamless. And everything that you're saying about building it together, spending extra time and care on it, like you felt that.
Yeah, it was I think it was a constant. We were constantly in conversation.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of, like, as I don't want to talk too much about specifics because there are probably some people who are listening who did not see the play, and the play could come back. Fair. So I don't know. The play could do something else, and sure, I don't want to like give away the sort of elements of the play that are a bit of a surprise, you know?
Yeah.
But in building like the moment with Crystal, mm-hmm, towards the latter end of the play.
I know what you're talking about. I'm like, if y'all haven't seen it, just you wait.
And yes, if you don't know, you won't know. You like that.
I love that. But yes, that moment.
So that moment, mm-hmm, specifically, I remember us slowly building that moment and Steve Jordan rewriting that the scene that led up to the moment in which she's revealed, mm-hmm, a few times, and it was a conversation. I'm about to say Stevie. Yeah, Stevie is so great about, like, if there's a good idea in the room, he will try it.
Yeah, he's a great leader to me, right?
Yeah,
you know,
like one time I said something, I was like, "Why are they doing that?" And I said it under my breath, just like thinking to myself.
Yeah,
and he was like, yes, that's what we're going to do. And I was like, no, I didn't mean, I wasn't trying to be smart. I just was asking, I'm so sorry. And he was like, no, that's what we're going to do.
Wow.
And I had a moment the whole time. I'm like, he'll probably listen to this someday. And be like, I was panicking. I was like, Stevie hates me.
I
was like, Fedna, I can't believe. She was like, no, Marsha, he has no ego.
Yeah.
There's like zero ego.
Yeah.
And so like when I said the thing, I think he just was like, oh, I didn't think of that.
Right.
So let's try it.
I love that.
And, you know, in terms of building the whole show, for me, especially in the beginning, the Pastor Freeman,
mm-hmm,
and building that was a slow process.
Really?
I mean, it was slow and fast at the same time. The first day I came in with like the first three pages or two and a half pages memorized, mm-hmm, at least.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And I remember like coming in and having, I watched a pastor from Elevation Church.
Okay.
Stephen Furtick's Elevation Church. Mm-hmm. And I liked his energy.
Yeah.
And then I brought that in and Stevie was like liking it. But then he was like, but I feel like this pastor's a little older. And so then I start looking up videos of Farrakhan preaching.
Uh-huh.
And I start incorporating some of my pastor and pastor friend from back home, Omari Hughes.
Okay.
Because when he catches the spirit, you feel it.
Yes.
You know, I mean, the ancestors feel it.
Right.
And that moment in which the pastor catches the spirit and goes into the visions he sees.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of like use that. So I like kind of splice together all the sort of pastors that excite me.
Right.
And sort of preachers that excite me. And a little bit of Eddie Murphy.
Okay, yes. No, the energy was so there with that character. And I love that kicked off the show.
Yeah.
Which I don't think is a spoiler. But like, and I won't spoil the moments you had, but you also had some chance to improv when people were late to the show. But like, mm-hmm, I mean, what did you develop a repertoire of like improv for those moments?
At first it was like me figuring out the fact that people was just going, show their asses up. I'm sorry, language. Show their asses up. I'm sorry, language.
I love it. No, I love it. I love it.
Show up late. So the first time I'm like, oh my God, y'all, this is my first off-Broadway show.
Yeah.
And y'all going, like, this is like a moment. Like,
yes.
Also, forget about it being about me, because it's not about me. It's a moment for this. The beginning of the play is a funeral.
Yes.
We're at a funeral.
Okay.
So how dare you come late to somebody's funeral?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So for me, it was just like being in the world of the play. I had to acknowledge it in any way I could in the world of the play. Mm-hmm. Now, over time, I developed a good like five different things that I would say.
Okay.
That would always get the same reaction.
Yep.
There were, I think I had, I don't want to give them away.
No, you don't have to. You don't have to.
But I had like one I would say, and then there was one that we like added in, like Jordan, we were playing around with. And then sometimes it would just be a person, and I would take it off the person, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like one time it was like a white person came, and I was like, look who's on CP time, amen. So
good.
And so you like I don't know, you sort of find it,
yeah,
as the show, as the run goes on, right. It got more. I will say in the beginning it was really nerve-wracking,
okay,
because it's a lot that I'm holding and juggling in that first bit.
Mm-hmm.
But by like after we got the previews, or like maybe the second week of previews, I was
you
know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're like in it. You're right. Like playing now.
Right.
I think there was one night, one lady looked so confused on the stairs. I went up, I grabbed her, and I took her to a seat.
No. Yes, that is too good.
Yeah. So it's like I found it as the run, once we got into the run, mm-hmm. After previews, I found a more like consistent four or five things that I would just
rotate through.
Yep, yeah. Rotate through whenever I felt, and then sometimes somebody would surprise me.
Right,
and if they surprised me, I would go off whatever they did.
But you have to be present.
You in that opening monologue,
mm-hmm.
You have to be present because sometimes it's such a tough piece to talk about if a lot of people haven't seen it, but. What happens is I have this monologue. I'm a preacher in the beginning of the play, and I'm talking directly to the audience.
Right.
That is the basic mm-hmm. Premise.
Yeah.
And so when you're talking directly to the audience, just in my mind, I have like placed certain people in places, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But I like to talk directly to the people that are in the audience. Mm-hmm. Like I find people that hear me, and if they don't hear me, I find somebody that will.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that was like the excitement and the fun in that. And I remember even one day during that sermon, somebody before I even got to the end, somebody stood up and was like, "Oh, you, you playing with us now, Pastor?" And I was like, "Geez." So like, you kind of have to go with whatever's in the room.
Right. Right.
Which is such a fun for me. Mm-hmm. I'm one of those actors where I enjoy working like that. Like yeah. The film I did, The Day Shall Come, yes. Which is on video on demand right now. You can get it on iTunes, Amazon, or in your local listing, whatever that may be. But in that process, it was a lot of sort of improv and finding things
mm-hmm.
In the moment as well. And I actually, as an actor, I enjoy that.
Yeah.
I enjoy being able to add bits and pieces of my own.
Yeah.
Just because I feel a sense of ownership of it
mm-hmm.
In a way.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm very gracious for directors when they allow that. And I'm gracious when I'm in a play or a film that allows me to do that. Not everything does.
Sure, sure.
But
that makes the ones when you do so much sweeter.
Yeah, like when you do and you enjoy doing it. Like I enjoy improv. I've taken class at the Pit and things like that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I enjoy it.
Yeah.
And so when you're given the opportunity to do it, you kind of just run
with it.
Yeah. Because you don't get it very often.
But what I loved about that too, like specifically that first opening and even the monologue that Jordan does to introduce the show,
mm-hmm.
was it set the stage of like, this was written by a black person, this is for black people, like contains black references, and we know there's going to be white people in the audience, but this is your black church, like, you know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. it set the scene that it wasn't written for the white gaze, which I loved, and it just seemed to open up this freedom, especially your monologue too, like opened up this freedom for black people who are often maybe feeling excluded from the theater to be themselves.
Yeah.
You know, with the praise break even. Or,
I mean, or with the playlist.
With the playlist is so good.
Like the playlist in the beginning.
Who came up with the playlist?
I think that's a combination of Stevie Walker Webb, maybe a little bit of Jordan, and definitely the sound engineer, Emily, okay. Who is fantastic. Yeah. She's great. She's very good.
Oh, man.
So I think it's a combination of all their geniuses put together.
That effort, yeah.
Yeah. And so and the great thing about, like, you don't get those many gifts in all the work that you do. You know what I mean? You don't get to be able to. Everybody isn't going to be that risky.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really exciting when you have it because it allows you so much to play with.
Yeah.
It's like when actors are given gold, they mine it. You know what I mean?
For sure.
And so it's a testament really to Jordan E. Cooper.
Shout
out. As a writer, and what he was able to do at the young age of 29, because he's like, he's still a baby. I don't even know how old he is now. I be saying that boy is 19 years old. I was like, he wrote the play when he was 19, y'all. 19 years old.
It's too good.
Jordan like, motherfucker.
Right.
I'm not 19.
That's so good.
Yeah.
My last question about it, because I want to talk about your other projects too, but I could talk about Ain't No Mo forever. We don't have to talk about, you know, we don't have to spoil, reveal, but the last moment that y'all share on stage with the flag, what was that moment like for you? Did your feelings change every night, or was it always like a sense of release?
That last moment is a tough moment for me in the play, because it's like, you know, it's a combination of things. One, it with us coming out was because, you know, they wanted us to have a curtain call. And so there had to be a moment to like cap the experience.
Mm.
But the thing with that moment is that every night it would be so vastly different in terms of the audience and the audience's response.
Yeah.
Sometimes people would be in a state of shock and I think processing. Some nights people would clap right away. And for some reason that just for me felt a little
jarring.
It felt a little jarring, a little tone deaf. I hate to like say that about an audience, but like,
but for your experience,
but for my experience, it's like, because we were looking out into the audience, you see how conflicted so many people are, and so the people that start the clap feel like they're clapping out of a place of discomfort. You know what I mean?
Sure.
It feels like sometimes it felt that way. Sometimes it felt like they were genuinely like, my body has to do something, and so I'm going to do this. But sometimes it felt like people wanted to get out of what the moment was. And then there were times in which it felt like a release. It felt like after that we could walk home and like be ourselves again. Because we play so many characters. And so I remember specifically every night we would come out and people would be like, oh, they're fine. Somebody was like, look, he's right. He's fine.
Oh, wow.
They're fine.
Wow.
Because we went on such a journey, each of us individually as actors.
Yep.
And so I think part of that is a moment for us to just like let it go.
Yeah.
And two, for the audience to actually see us. To be forced to see us.
Absolutely.
To be forced to see us against that backdrop. To be forced to see us here in America. To be forced to acknowledge us. To be forced to give us space and room.
Yeah.
You know, I still remember one night Coleman Domingo came. And I admired that man so much.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that night because we had all come out, and then as we were leaving, all you heard is, bravo.
Dang!
And then the clap, 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 clap. But all you heard was, bravo.
Yes! Mic drop, bravo.
It was. That's how it felt.
Yeah.
It was like a mic drop, bravo.
How?
And so you, I don't know, that moment, it, because it was so different every night, I have a lot of mixed emotions towards it. Mm-hmm. Like, sometimes I'm like, why are y'all clapping?
Mm.
Did y'all just watch that?
Right.
And then sometimes I'm like, oh, you could clap now. Like, today, this performance, you could, you know, yeah. Like, or sometimes, yeah. I felt like, I'm glad we had that, to just like be able to step out of it.
Right. Okay.
It's so interesting because after that show, people be like, how do you take care of yourself? And we were like, we're fine.
Mm-hmm.
Because with that show, it allows you, I think also the way we built it.
Right.
It was because the way we built it, because Stevie Walker Webb made that space feel safe.
Good.
And warm.
Good.
And allow for us to be heard and seen and understood. And also made sure when things were triggering, he took care of his actors.
Good.
So it was because the way the space was built that I could walk away from that every night and be fine.
Mm.
Now, that's not always the case.
Mm-mm.
But because the way that space was built with that director and that group of people, I was absolutely fine, 100%. And that company manager, all of them, I was absolutely fine. You know what I mean?
Yes.
But it was because of the way we built the space. It was because when we first started, we had the conversation of, oh, you use the N-word in this monologue a lot when we're referring to the N-word outside of this. And we're referring to that word outside of the scene. We're going to say N-word instead of saying the actual word.
Oh.
So, like, we don't have to listen to the white stage manager say it every 5 minutes when they're trying to give us a line note.
Snaps,
you know what I mean?
Snaps.
And so, like, it's just I think everybody was just very conscious of the way we were building it.
Wow.
To take care of the actors in the space.
That's so essential.
Yeah.
That makes my heart so happy to hear.
Yeah.
You know? When you said Coleman Domingo, too, that made me think of the night, one of the many nights that I came. Angela Davis was in the audience.
Yes, she was.
A lot of celeb sightings there.
Yes. Angela said it's one of the most necessary pieces of theater.
Oh, it is. Yeah. I could not agree more.
Jordan E. Cooper, man.
Who was one of your favorite celeb moments, if you could choose?
It was the one I mentioned.
It was Coleman.
It was Coleman being like, bravo.
Ooh!
Because it's Coleman Domingo, and he's also from Philly. I've looked up to him for years. I remember his performance of in Passing Strange,
uh-huh,
at the Public years ago. Like,
wow.
So for me, I was like, afterwards, I went up to him and I was like, Coleman, just so you know, your work has inspired me through the years, blah, 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 blah.
Oh my God,
and
yes!
Then he was like, young man, you've inspired me tonight. He's like, and I was like,
can you believe that? One of your inspirations say you inspired him.
Well, he was just like, he was very, I think he was moved and taken by the piece,
yeah,
and by what we were doing. And so I was. It was great to be able to share that with somebody I admire.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean?
I do. That is a full circle moment.
Yeah, and it feels like you're doing something.
Right, right.
It feels like, because, you know, you're constantly grinding in this business.
Mm, right. We were talking about that before.
Yeah, we were talking about that before we started the recording.
The recording.
The recording.
Because, but like you said, burnout is real.
It is real.
You know?
And so, like, I think you got to remember those moments, right? You got to remember those, and not as like a cocky way, like, I'm so good, but like on those days where you're like, oh, I need to go back to Idaho, or mm-hmm, for me, Philadelphia, or mm-hmm, I'm moving back to North Carolina. Forget this. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you got to remember those moments that, like, when somebody sort of, I hate to say like those moments of validation, because it's less that, but it's more like the moments where you realize like you're in this and you're doing, yeah, the thing that you set out to do. You're living the thing.
Affirmation.
You're living the dream.
Yeah.
The affirmations, each and every moment, the mm-hmm fact that those people came to the show.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and yes, work will come and go. And I think every actor, I remember talking to my agent after that job was finished, and I was like, am I going to work again?
Wow.
And he was like, if I could tell you how many times Audra McDonald asked me, is she going to work again? And I was like, really?
Oh, my goodness.
God, then I'm screwed. No, I'm just I'm joking.
It's like, if Audra could feel that way, though, then,
no, yeah,
know,
which made me go, okay, okay, okay. So like this feeling never goes away. But so you need to just like hold tight to those moments in which you sort of where it felt like a bit cathartic or
And we talked about too before about making sacrifices.
Yeah.
You know? I from my perspective where I'm sitting, I feel like this hits members of marginalized communities more than, let's say, white counterparts, of saying no to roles that you think aren't a right fit for you.
Mm-hmm.
Even if people think they are. Does that make sense?
You know, I'm not going to say the show because I don't want to put anybody on blast.
No.
But I was asked to audition for something, and the leads were a white woman and a black man, and they were married, and they have this child, and I would have played said child. And so I said, well, since said child be like a little, like I am as dark as midnight, and I'm not like knocking my skin. I love my midnight skin.
Yes.
Like,
yeah.
I love it. But I don't know if I could play a mixed race child. You
right,
know what I mean?
Right. Sure,
and
sure.
Also, that experience is very specific.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, you know what? I remember talking to somebody that was working on the project and being like, yeah, that just wasn't for me.
Mm.
And also, they should know better.
Right.
But they don't because it's the room doesn't look like us.
And they don't understand the specificity of different experiences.
Yeah, they don't understand the nuance of it. They think it can be just one thing, and I think that's where they're wrong. But hey, what do I know? I just live it every day.
Ooh, let them know. Speak on it.
Just,
no, but that's real.
Yeah,
you know, and I think actors too. You're in a very interesting, or I know you're more than an actor, but like someone acting on stage. I think it's a very particular position to be in as well because you have the casting directors, you have the producers, you have the directors, you have the creative team, and then y'all are expected to come in, and sometimes you're not allowed to give input and your voices aren't heard in the room unless it's a very special experience like with Ain't No Mo. So I would imagine that'd be tricky to navigate as well.
It is tricky to navigate, but you sort of like, you learn those spaces and you as a young actor, what I'm finding is that when that happens, I clock it for myself and I go, oh, I don't ever want to be put in this position again.
Mm-hmm.
Or like where I feel absolutely helpless.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like where, you know, you don't want to be put in a position where you feel like your voice doesn't matter at all, ever.
Right, right.
That's just like you don't want to feel like you're in the sunken place every time you go to work.
Ooh, no.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You want to feel like you're still in your body and you have some ownership over the thing that you're doing. And I mean, it's going to be you up there regardless, so you do have the ownership. But you learn to say no to things. You learn when, like, not to work off or in the place of scarcity and just work in the place of abundance and know that, like, will come regardless of whether the phone is ringing right now or not.
That's beautiful. But it can be scary and overwhelming to remember that because it doesn't always feel that way.
It never feels that way.
You know?
Or at least I haven't felt that way where I'm like, but I have to remind, I've never felt that way where I'm like, oh yes, absolutely, I can say no to anything. Like, I'm going to get a job tomorrow.
Right.
No, I'm like, oh man, how am I going to pay these bills?
Yeah, if I say no to this.
My Fedna sent me a meme the other day, which was really funny. Which was like somebody cooking invisible food.
Oh yeah, this is me chopping up my food with my exposure money or whatever.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And I was like, that's so real.
Yeah.
Like, as an actor, you need. I keep saying like, I hate that. You need to be realistic about the things you want and also just find a way to manage those things and get the thing that you want and need as opposed to work in a place of scarcity.
Yes. I love that. Working from a place of abundance.
Yeah. You got to work from a place of abundance because
that's the only way that you can stay, I feel like, present.
Yes.
You know, and engaged with it all.
Yeah. You know, one of my good friends, Lee Edward Colston, who is currently writing on season 4 of Fargo and has a show going up at the New Victory Theater in Chicago.
Okay.
Or not the New Victory, Victory Gardens, sorry.
Okay. Victory Gardens.
Yes, 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 yes. He told me that a while ago. Because I was like, sometimes you get so scared that nothing else is going to come, so you take the first thing that you see.
Right.
Or whatever. And sometimes you got to do that, you got to do whatever it takes to sort of get you over the hump. But like, you also know it's a powerful word, and you can say that.
Absolutely. Remember that, kids. Remember it.
Yeah. No is just as powerful as yes. Actually, no is yes in a different way. No is a yes somewhere else. A no here is a yes somewhere, you
Ooh,
know?
Ooh, I love that.
Yeah.
I'm going to write that down in my journal tonight, y'all. That's real. But so you are still thriving because you have your next gig and you already had your movie, you have your Lincoln Center Great Society gig, like you're killing it.
Yeah.
I want to know for Baby Marchant, who was on the set
of Beloved,
right? And now being a lead in The Day Shall Come.
With Anna Kendricks and Danielle Brooks and Dennis O'Hare.
Like, can you give me that full circle moment? Like, how was that to be back on this set as the lead? Thinking about Baby Marchant being an extra.
I just remember meeting Dennis O'Hare for the first time and him being like, "You're the guy." And I was like, I was like, "What do you mean?" He's like, "You're the guy. You're number one." So on a set, you know, you got number one, number two, number three, number four, all the way down to however many people that are on that set working as actors.
Yeah.
And I was number one on that call sheet. And so Dennis said that to me, and I think I didn't get snappy, but I got kind of like, what does that mean? I was just like, what does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody keeps making jokes and I don't understand.
Right.
Like, what does that mean? What does that even, what, number one, what is, I like, why?
Yeah.
Why y'all keep talking about it? Why does, it means a lot more to everybody else than it means to me. And I just want to understand what that means.
Mm.
And he goes, he goes, well, in my career, I've worked as a number five and number six. Occasionally I'm a number three. But I digress. He goes, number one sets the tone for how we're going to work in the space.
Wow.
Number one is the one who goes and does all the press and is the face of the film. And number the one is the one we look to see how we're going to work and how we're going to do this thing.
Yeah.
And he looks at me and goes, and we get to do it together. And
that's amazing.
I know. I was like, I like you, Dennis O'Hare.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
I like, so for me, it was, you know, it was a little scary in the beginning. But then I realized that like all the things that I've done and all the jobs that it led up to that point have taught me all that I needed to know for that moment.
Mm-hmm.
Like I had all the tools I needed to succeed.
Yeah.
And I just had to And I just had to trust that.
Absolutely. Which can also be scary.
Yes. I mean.
You know. But you're good at taking leaps here and believing.
Yeah. And so young Marchant was very, very excited. And he still is very excited. He's excited that people are getting to see it. The one thing about film that's so exciting is that people will be able to see that until the end of time.
Yeah.
So like some people see it now and in 5 years from now more people will discover it. And that's really, young Marchant is really excited by that. And to see where I am in 5 years from now.
Right.
Yeah.
And that you'll always have this marker of time, like you can look back and be like, I've grown so much since then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The other thing that people can see you in right now is The Great Society at Lincoln Center.
Yes.
Vivian Beaumont Theater, y'all. That's a beautiful theater.
It is.
That as y'all probably know listening, is about LBJ second term.
Yes, his second term.
Civil
and his decision
No, you got it.
It's his first term technically. For 4 years. And it's his decision not to run for an actual second term. Because his he took over for JFK.
Right. I guess I was considering that his first term. But
yeah.
Okay. And it's about like the civil rights voting act.
It's about a number of things. So
it's
it's the Vietnam War and the civil rights and trying to get voting rights down the South, and also his other policies. While also he's like deteriorating and realizing that he can't do this.
And it's a lot.
It's a lot.
It's a big play. I went and saw it, and There's a lot of history packed in there. And I was just curious about your dramaturgy work, because you play Stokely Carmichael.
Yes.
What was it like diving back into the history archives of like the civil rights movement and everything?
For me, it was really exciting to play Stokely because I feel like he's one that is ever so slightly misunderstood.
Mm-hmm.
I think that so many people think that Black Power stood for like violence. And actuality, Stokely Carmichael was the leader of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee.
Right, right.
And so when he was referring to Black Power, when he spoke on Black Power, he was talking about Black Power in the South, Black political power. Because mm-hmm. in counties like Lawrence County, Black people were the majority. They were the majority of the population, but didn't hold any political power.
Mm-hmm.
And so for him, he tried to start a political party down there called the Lawrence County Freedom Party, in which Black people would have a say in who and what they what the policies were, you know,
mm-hmm.
And who they voted for. They would not have to just vote for these two separate parties.
Mm.
And you know, I think it's exciting to be able to dive back into such a historic and sort of iconic man. And I'm sort of like itching for somebody to tell his whole story because I feel like
that would be cool.
He has a lot more to say than he's given. Anywhere you see him throughout history with it, whether it be a documentary about King, like he has a lot to say that like we sort of kind of bleep out, you know what I mean? But I think he was so honest. And there's one thing that I want to say before we leave you, is that Stokely said something during a press conference that rang true for me, which is he thought Martin Luther King was making a fallacious assumption. Mm. And that assumption was that nonviolence would work. He believed that nonviolence was good, but Martin Luther King assumed that nonviolence could work if your opponent saw your suffering and innately felt something for you.
Mm.
That would assume that America, your opponent, had a conscience during that time, and there was none.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We need to get Stokely his own narrative.
Yeah, we do.
His own thing.
We do. You can't fight with crazy.
No.
You can't fight I mean, like...
Yeah.
He was just like, in the way we're fighting, it's not working.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't like, let's go stab people. But he was like, what you doing right here? Getting people stabbed.
Mm.
So what else are we going to do?
Like, let's reassess.
Let's reassess. Because right now we got people over here ready to burn some stuff down.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And if we don't reassess, then they go and burn some stuff down. Mm-hmm. Which people, and I mean, there have been riots throughout time.
Yeah. History cyclical.
Yes, it is. I mean, what?
Yeah. So I know we got to get you to the theater to go do the Great Society. Yes. The rapid fire questions to wrap up with. One, if you could give a piece of Black art, recommend a piece of Black art, whether it's a film, a book, a TV show for our listeners to take in, what would it be?
Dolomite Is My Name.
Oh, he knew. Okay. Number two, if you could give a shout
out. I just saw it. That's a.
No, I love it. That was good. And then if you could give a shout out to a fellow Black artist, who would it be?
If I could give a shout out to a fellow Black artist.
Which I know is not fair because people are like, there's so much love to give. And we love that. If you want to do a top three, it's just to elevate some folks that have been on your mind.
I would probably say some friends from high school that are pretty phenomenal. One would be Julian King.
Okay.
He was recently on the season of The Voice.
Ooh, all right. The Voice.
He sang a song called All Time Low. And it's bomb.
Okay.
You should go listen to him.
Okay.
He has an album coming out soon.
Shout out.
Yes. And my friend Lee Edward Colston, because he's phenomenal and he's a phenomenal artist and he deserves any and everything that's coming his way.
Shout out to y'all. We love you. We love you. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
If folks want to follow you on social media.
I'm at Marshawn Davis on Instagram and Twitter, and at Marshawn Davis official Marshawn Davis on Facebook.
Just Google it, y'all. Thank you. Until next time, y'all.